Now we were speaking yesterday about M, the Diet of Augsburg. And we noticed how the confession at this diet was written by Melanchthon. And Melanchthon made it in some ways very concessive. Certain of the Protestant doctrines he brought out in it, not by stating them, but by simply omitting what would be the Romanist statement on the particular matter. He tried to make it concessive, and yet he stood on the main Protestant teachings. And it was read in a secret private session before the diet, that is, before the members of the diet, no outsiders allowed, read before them, and then John Eck and a group of others were appointed to make an answer, which they read a few days later, and then it was declared that it had been completely refuted. And the diet took action that the Protestants were given until April 15, 1531 to recant their position and to come into full unity with the Roman Church again. And if that was not done by April 15, 1531, then all who held to the Roman position were to proceed with arms against them and to subdue them as enemies of the empire and outlaws. So that this Augsburg Diet is important as beginning a sharp division of those who took the one position and those who took the other, and it is important as the occasion on which this confession was written. Now I notice that the moving picture Martin Luther is to be shown this Friday night here, and anyone who has had this course will find the picture very interesting, I think more interesting than one who has not found it. There's a great deal of material in the picture. There are many things in it which you simply slide over if it's the first time you've seen it and you don't know much about the period. It is when it first came out, I was talking to a Jewish fellow at the University of Pennsylvania who was quite a habitué of moving pictures, and he had seen it. It was, as you know, in commercial theaters for a while, went all across the country shortly after it was first made. And he had seen this, and he, with no particular interest in religion, and certainly none in Protestant Christianity, said that it was the best moving picture he'd seen in about a year. I think that speaks well for the standard of its making as an interesting picture. It was made by a group of Lutherans who were not necessarily in sympathy with full supernatural religion. Some of them were, some of them undoubtedly were not. And certainly they have, in a few places, given what I think is an incorrect idea of the historical situation. But comparatively few. On the whole, they have given a pretty good picture of the situation at that day, and they have crammed a great deal of material into it, with the result that I believe I've seen it three times, maybe four, and every time I've noticed interesting things that I had not noticed before that fit in with the historical situation. So I think that I wish in a way that you could, we could complete our work on Luther before you saw it, because you'd be even better prepared to get the most out of it. But I think you'll find it, if you see it, very interesting, and I think it will make quite vivid some of the things that we have brought out in fact here. I don't like the picture it gives of Stauffus. It represents him as sort of an old fuddy-duddy and does not give him the credit for the real Christian character and attitude that historically I'm sure he did have. It shows the Pope Leo X, whom the historical records of the time say said, "God has given us the papacy, let us enjoy it." And certainly that was his primary interest, was in enjoying it. Everything historical about him proves that. And the picture you get of him in the moving picture gives you that impression of him. But they have him say this, but add something to it that I'm sure there's no evidence he added, which takes the curse off it completely. They have him say, "God has given us the papacy, let us enjoy it and use it for his glory." And as you see what a change that makes, and there's no historical evidence that he actually did say those words or that he was particularly interested in anything except his own glory. But, and then Melanchthon, it shows Melanchthon at the Council of, at Augsburg, and it shows Melanchthon as saying only theologians should sign this confession. And then it shows the Duke saying, "No, we're going to testify to our faith. We're going to sign this And I believe that is a true fact, that it was the dukes and the secular leaders there who were greatly moved by Luther and who made the big stand there. But it does give, I think, too unfavorable a picture of Melanchthon. Melanchthon has not been much praised in Lutheran circles since that day. We'll see the reason for it later on. It was not for anything at that time. But I think they downgrade him far more than he deserves to be. He certainly, Luther wouldn't have thought as highly of him as he did if he had not been a much more able man than that picture shows. But these are comparatively small blemishes on what I think is a very helpful thing in giving an idea of the situation in those days and of the progress of the events. Well, this Diet of Augsburg was of great importance in church history, partly because that was when this Augsburg Confession was written. And the Augsburg Confession is to this day the primary doctrinal symbol of Lutheranism throughout the world. There are other symbols added to it, but nothing has ever been substituted for it. It remained one of their primary doctrinal standards. Now, I'm going to put as a session, number four was the action of the Diet. I'm going to simply call number five the political events from 1530 to 1532. I had thought of giving this a separate Roman numeral, but since our principal interest in it is to see what happened about this action that on April 15, 1531, they were going to take up arms, all of them, against the Protestants, it can logically be subsumed under this heading of the Diet of Augsburg. So under 5a, we'll call number one, formation of the Schmalkaldic League. Schmalkaldic is S-C-H-M-A-L-K-A-L-D-I-C. Schmalkaldic. S-C-H-M-A-L-K-A-L-D-I-C. It is a word that you come across considerably in accounts of the history of this period. We will not spend much time on the relation to the event of which it is connected. We will look at the main thing. But the reason for the name is because at a place called Schmalkald, some of the Protestant leaders met and made an agreement to stand together against any attack upon them. And for the next nearly 20 years, this league was of considerable importance. There was even a time when King Henry VIII of England considered joining the Schmalkaldic League. But was more than 10 years before the time came that there was a war in which it was actively involved. I would call A, and then just mention here, we have already noticed the death of Zwingli, which occurred in 1531. The Swiss were not included in this Schmalkaldic League, only those who agreed with Luther's idea of the Lord's Supper. There were delays in conquering Protestantism by force. The day came and went, and nothing was done about it, because the emperor found himself in political circumstances in which he had to again postpone handling this thing in which he was so greatly interested in bringing to a stop. He had to maintain his power, and he was constantly menaced by the French. He was found the Pope constantly maneuvering behind his back against him, and the Turks were moving in. And so we'll mention 5b, increased Turkish menace. The Ottoman Turks had two or three centuries before taken over control of the Muslims in the Near East. They were constantly increasing their power. In 1453, they had taken Constantinople, and then they moved forward and had conquered the Balkan countries and Greece. They entered Hungary about this time. They conquered a good bit of Hungary. They got right into Austria, the very headquarters from which the Emperor Charles's ancestors had come. And so there was this increased Turkish menace, and there were some who said, well, this serves the emperor right for his attitude and his refusal to take a stand for the gospel. for the Turks to come, we should not do anything to try to help him. There were those who took that attitude. That was on one side. And on the other side, the popes took the attitude, well, we're afraid Charles is getting too much power. We won't help him. I won't help him against the Turks unless he makes concessions. And so he constantly found that the various popes made difficulty about giving him their support against the Turks. And meantime, during a long period here, the Turks had been moving forward step by step and conquering more and more territory, and it looked as if eventually they would take all of Europe into their hands. And people asked Luther, what should we do? And some said, we should not fight against the Turks. God has sent them as a scourge. Let us simply present the gospel and stand for peace. And on October 9, 1528, Luther wrote a letter, which he dedicated to Philip of Hesse, which he called On the Turkish War. He said, certain persons have been begging me for the past 5 years to stir up our people against the Turk, and now as he's actually approaching, conditions compel me to fulfill this duty. I regret to learn that some mistaken preachers in Germany instruct the people not to fight against the Turk. Some are so silly as to say it does not become a Christian to bear arms, and some say that the Germans are such a wild and wicked folk, half devil and half man, that they need the Turk to rule them. And he says, I dedicate this book to your grace as a powerful, famous prince. And the book was urging the evangelical leaders to give their whole support to the emperor in opposing the Turks and stopping this menace which threatened to completely conquer Europe. In another pamphlet which Luther wrote, he said, what people now write and say about war being such a curse is true. But we should remember how much greater a curse may sometimes be avoided by war. And of course, he is right, his attitude is right. War is a bad thing, but when others stir up war in order to try to bring people into complete tyrannical subjection, as the Russians have done to Czechoslovakia and half of Europe and most of Asia, it is the duty of everyone who wishes freedom for the presentation of the gospel, who wishes an orderly world, a world in which there's any liberty, to oppose their efforts in every possible way. And Luther was very strong in this, and I think we can safely say that a great part of Charles's eventual success in holding back the Turks, in stopping their progress, and in starting the movement which eventually pushed them back, was due to the support which came from Luther's followers, whom Luther urged to support the emperor in this, even though the emperor was trying to get an opportunity to destroy Luther. Luther supported the emperor in this because he felt that it was the Christian thing to do in defending the order and the freedom of the Christian world against the movement which was attempting to destroy it. But this Turkish menace God used in keeping the emperor busy, along with the popes undermining the emperor, who they were afraid was getting too strong, and the French constantly looking for a chance to attack him and seizing some of his property, some of his land, because they also were afraid of his tremendous power, which he had acquired through the marriages that his grandfather had arranged. But it was Luther's strong support, which perhaps has much to do with the fact that today, instead of having mosques all over Europe and the Christians, a little group of persecuted people as they have been in Egypt and in Persia and the other countries for the last 5 centuries, that Christianity has continued in Europe. But then 5C, the Nuremberg Truce. The Nuremberg Truce. On July 23rd, 1532, the Romanist nobles, by this time, had come to see that the emperor had his hands full with the external problems and could not bring his great forces and the money that was coming in tremendous quantities from the mines of Mexico and Peru to his court in Spain. He could not bring them fully to bear to put down Protestantism until he had first dealt with the immediate measures of things such as the progress of the Turks that were threatening the continuance of Christian Europe at all. They saw that there was, even though most of them held back from giving him much support, except when he would give them some special concession for it, yet they saw that he couldn't help them in trying to destroy Protestantism under those circumstances, and that their own force alone was not sufficient to do it. And so on that day, they also saw how the Schmalkaldic League, although not as strong as it would have been if they had had the Swiss with them, was still strong enough that they could hardly subdue the Protestants without the help of the emperor's forces. They made this truce in which they... Yes, sir?
I guess who
they are. The Romanist dukes and leaders in the German territory. They who had been determined after the Diet of Augsburg to destroy Protestants. They now, seeing the Schmalkaldic League having this much power, and knowing that at present, at least, nothing but a long war that nobody could be sure who would win would come if they attacked the Protestant states, they made a truce in 1532. And in this truce, they promised that they would, for the time being, continue the conditions made in the Diet of Spires in 1526. In other words, that each duke, each king, or the people of each imperial free city, of which there were maybe a dozen of the great cities which were responsible only to the emperor, that each of these would make its own determination as to religious situations within its territory, and that for the time being, none of them would interfere with each other, they said, until there should be a general council held, and a general council which would decide the doctrinal matter. And of course, the idea being that once such a general council decided the doctrinal matters, then everyone would have to fall in line with the decisions that were made. But this truce was made then, and actually what they had in mind was, there's no use of being on a position of constant warlike basis where our whole situation of life is greatly hampered as long as we don't see our way to win. Let's have a peaceful situation until we have sufficient strength and the emperor is free with his forces to join us and put an end to Protestantism. And it was another dozen years before they saw the chance to do it, and they finally did completely conquer every Protestant force in Germany. But that was a dozen years later. Yes, sir?
Could you give the date again?
Yes, sir.
Luther's
I think that was about 1528. I did not memorize that date, I just read it out.
And the date for the Nuremberg
Truce? July 23rd, 1532. Some of these events, particularly between 1517 and 1523, I'd like you to know the particular year when most things happened. After those are the years of the big star of the Reformation. Then after 1523, you ought to know within 4 or 5 years at least, all these important things along here. When we get along further to know within 20 or 30 years will be sufficient. But this is a period, I'd like you to know within, say, a decade from this time on, because we're going to look at various countries to see events which interlaced, and we want to have an idea of what the general situation was in Germany when something important was happening in England or some other country that we'll look at later. Yes? No, this was made by the Romanist dukes with the Protestant dukes, simply that they would not fight each other for the time being. That was all. It was the emperor's forces that fought the Turks. And the Protestants, in response to Luther's strong urging, a great many of them joined the emperor's army to fight against the Muslims. The Romanist dukes also sent contingents. But in many cases, the emperor had to pay them or give them special concessions to get them to help him against the Turks. while with the Protestant forces, the individuals, many volunteered as a result of Luther's strong urging that it was the duty of the Christians to strongly defend, support the emperor in this defense of Europe. And the popes, during this time, they were constantly demanding concessions from the emperor, special privileges if they would give their support to his war. But Luther's stand was, whatever's right, I'm going to stand for, no matter who else is for it or who else is against it. And whatever's wrong, I'm going to oppose, no matter who else is for it or against it. He tried to take his stand on principles rather than personalities also. I don't say he altogether succeeded. No human being has ever altogether succeeded. We're all fallible. Luther had his weaknesses and his faults, as everyone else has had. But he certainly was one of the, he was not only one of the ablest men in all history, he was certainly one of the men who had as fine a general attitude and a complete thoroughgoing loyalty to what he considered to be right as any man you would find in history. Well, that is all we will speak of on these events during these three rather crucial years. But now we will, for a minute, for a little, look at what's been happening outside of Germany during these years. And so we will call N, capital N, the early spread of Luther's teachings outside Germany. One great advantage, as you know, in those years was that Latin was understood by all scholars. And consequently, all scholars could understand what others wrote. And the scholars were traveling a fair amount among different countries in those days. And Luther was recognized as a scholar before anyone thought of him as a leader of the Reformation. And his works began to be distributed, and they continued to be distributed for some time before strong efforts were made to stop their distribution outside of the territories that were that favored them. We look first briefly at England. We'll look much more fully at England later on. But now, number one, Luther's teachings outside Germany. Number one, England. And under this, we briefly glance at the king, small a, Henry VIII. Henry VIII was the king of England, who is as important as any English king in all history in church history. As far as his relationship to church history is concerned, the next three rulers after him, his three children, and then the next three after that, these seven have especially great importance in church history. And I will want you eventually to learn their dates. But we are not going into England now, except just to show how what was happening there briefly now while Luther was presenting his teachings. But Henry VIII was a person who had a tremendous effect upon development because of two things. Because of the situation in which it was possible for him to have more influence than most rulers can have. And second, because of the character he had, in which made it possible to utilize to the fullest the opportunity he had of being a powerful influence. Now, as to the situation, first briefly, in the previous century, two different families, both of them descended from the King of England of a century earlier, had claimed to be the legitimate rulers of England. And for a time, the House of Lancaster would rule, and for a time, the House of York would rule, and then for a time, the House of Lancaster. And these two forces were fighting in England for many years. And great parts of England were devastated through this civil war in England, in which these two factions fought with each other. And it's interesting that over here in Pennsylvania, the early settlers named the principal city on one side, near the Susquehanna River, on one side Lancaster, and on the other side York. And that's called the War of the Roses, and I believe in the early days they put up the red roses on one side of the Susquehanna here by the bridge, and the white on the other, remembering these two houses of York and Lancaster. But most of the people of England realized during these years that they would occasionally have their property destroyed, to have marauding armies marching through, innocent bystanders would be injured, and the thing they longed for was stability and order in England. And finally, when a man who was related, but not closely related, to the House of Lancaster, won a battle in which he killed a member of the House of York, and then married the daughter of the previous king of the House of York, the great mass of the people of England united between these two, saying, let's have order and peace. And yet this man, Henry VII, had to put down a number of insurrections and never was quite sure that he would last. People weren't sure, but he did last a number of years and got England settled and stable. But still the memory of the periods of upheaval and turmoil, when there was no certainty who was the legitimate king of England, left a tremendous attitude on the part of the people that they wanted to have a ruler who was the ruler that would maintain law and order throughout England. And of course, with Henry VII, people could say, what right does he have to have the throne of England? Legitimate claims were quite scanty. But though his wife was a daughter of one of the York kings. But when Henry VII died, his son was the son of a king. And so there's no question that he was the one who had a right to be king. It's a silly idea, but it was well established in those days all through the world. He was the one who has a right to be king. And so most of the English people felt, well, there's no question about it. He's the one who has the right to be the king, and all English people must be subject to him and loyal to him. That was the attitude of a great many people, but a great many of them also had this attitude, oh, almost any king is better than the turmoil, upheaval, and disorder that we had in the Wars of the Roses. We have stability. And the worst thing in the world, in their minds, was to have a situation where there was uncertainty who was the one who had a right to be king. Well, to understand the English history for a century after this, you have to realize this fact. Because you find in the rest of this century, you find an English king strongly supporting Protestantism, and the people are obedient to him, and you think everybody was Protestant, and then you find his sister becoming ruler, and she takes a strong Romanist position, and nearly everybody says the Protestants are wicked, and their leaders have to flee the country, and many of them are burned at the stake, and you think all England was thoroughly Romanist. And then she dies and her sister, who the Protestant, takes over, and nearly everybody's very happy and they're strongly Protestant again. And some people say, what a fickle people, they go from one side to the other. Well, it wasn't that at all. It was that the people, remembering the Wars of the Roses, thought anything was better than a confusion as to who the ruler was and consequent disorder and upheaval in the land. Well, now Henry VIII thus was recognized as a legitimate ruler because his father had been king, even though there was a big question whether his father was a legitimate ruler. He was, because his father had been king. And everybody wanted a legitimate ruler that would give control, would give order in the land. And then, in addition to that, you have in Henry VIII a person of rare charm. I think I do not, if somebody wants to say he's one of the wickedest men in all history, I raise no objection to it. If somebody wants to say he murdered more people than almost any ruler they can think of, I do not object. If somebody wants to say he was a wicked man who had six wives and had two of them beheaded, why, that's in accord with the facts of history. But it is nevertheless the fact that he was a man of great charm. And those with whom he had much contact were easily charmed by his personality and were apt to follow when he became king in 1509, they said, the heavens laugh, the earth exults. All is full of milk and honey and nectar. Henry VIII had been the second son, and his older brother was supposed to be the king, but the older brother died. And so Henry VIII, who they thought would never be king, and so they had given him an education, thinking he should go into the church, which was many of the British noble families until quite recently. Their second son, they would think, would go into the church and become an archbishop or something. Well, Henry VIII was given an education beyond what most kings had. And he was very proud of his education. And he was also, he loved sports of every kind. He loved to get out into the tournament and to dash out against the other, the knights in the tournament. And he just seemed to everybody to be just a wonderful sort of person. And he hoped he could be elected emperor. And his supporters tried to get him elected when 12 years later, when Charles V was elected emperor. Though, of course, it would have been ridiculous to have an English king as emperor of Germany. But throughout his reign, he was trying to get a great position in international affairs, and he spent tremendous sums of money on it, and he never succeeded much in that. But as far as England was concerned, he was able to work things pretty much as he chose in England during the years from 1509 to 1547 when he died. And so this is the attitude of Henry VIII, small b, Luther's writings. Luther's writings began to come into England very early. Within a few months after the theses were written, people sent copies of them to their friends in England. By February 1519, a number of volumes of Luther's works had come into England, some of them even coming into the hands of the royal family. A bookseller at Oxford through 1520 was selling many books written by Luther, and a government official in London wrote to his son in the country and said, "There be heretics here which take Luther's opinion." In Cambridge, there were many young men who used to meet at a certain tavern regularly to meet there to discuss the new ideas. And so the other people called the tavern German and called these young men German because they were reading Martin Luther's works. And some of these men later became great leaders in the Reformation in England. And some of them were burned at the stake by Henry VIII's daughter, Mary Tudor, for their faith. And so Luther's views began to come into England very early. Then N.C., Defender of the Faith, in 1521, we've already mentioned that Henry wrote a work. He was very proud of his learning. He wrote a work in Latin called Defense of the Second Sacrament. He had a copy bound in gold and sent to the Pope. The Pope said it was the best antidote to heresy that yet had been produced, and gave him the title Defender of the Faith, which all English kings since that time have added to their titles, because the Pope gave it to Henry VIII for his attack upon Luther. So it's generally recognized that it was a rather poor book. And later on, when Henry tried to get Luther to stand on his side, Henry said that Sir Thomas More had, he said, by subtle, sinister slights unnaturally procured and provoked him to write against Luther. So he tried to blame Luther for it, and of course Luther and others tried to think that it wasn't Henry that wrote it, somebody else wrote it, and you shouldn't blame Henry for it. But anyway, he got his title for it, Defender of the Faith. And in 1520, he had a great many of Luther's books read, burnt publicly at St. Paul's in London. In the presence of many high dignitaries and a crowd of 30,000 spectators, his books were burned and his doctrine reprobated. And orders were given that his books should not be allowed to be circulated in England, but many of them kept coming in. Then we should mention a man who is perhaps as important in the English Reformation as any other. We'll call it D, William Tyndale. William Tyndale. Spelling was not yet standardized in those days. One way of spelling his name is T-Y-N-D-A-L-E. William Tyndale, as a young man, well educated, both at Oxford and Cambridge, read Erasmus, then studied Luther, and then studied Zwingli's writings, and he decided that the English people ought to have the Bible so they could read it in their own tongue. And Tyndale said he would like to make the Bible better known to the boy that runs behind the plow in the farm than it is now to most of the priests and even some of the bishops. And so he came into London and he found there the Bishop of London, who was quite a fine scholar, and he thought he'll be very happy in this, and asked him to give him support to make translation of the Bible into English. And instead of that, this scholar, knowing the attitude of the court toward Luther, denounced him and refused to support him. Tyndall had to flee to the continent. And there on the continent, he translated the New Testament into English, got it printed, and 6,000 copies of it, he had many of them smuggled into England. And this Bishop of London then immediately tried to buy them all. And somebody said, this bishop thought he had God by the toe when indeed he had the devil by the fist. Because he bought up the books and they were able to get a pretty good price for them, which enabled him to print a lot more. But Tyndall spent the rest of his life working on getting the whole Bible translated. He worked very hard on this, and he was hunted down on the continent and had to flee from one city to another, but he would find a printer who would secretly print these books and find ways of smuggling them into England. Eventually, the King of England got word to the local authorities where Tyndall was. Tyndall was seized, put in a dungeon for a few months, and then killed. And as he was taken out to be killed, he called out, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." And the King James Version, I've heard it said that 9 words out of 10 in it are exactly as Tyndall had translated. Tyndall was a man of a rare gift of translating and putting into clear, excellent, vivid English. He wrote many controversial tracts, but the style of them doesn't compare with the style of his translation. He studied very carefully what sort of a translation was desirable to represent God's word, and worked on it and did a marvelous task of doing it. Yes? He was killed on October 6th, 1536. 1536, near Brussels. Well, Tyndall is one of the great heroes of the Reformation. Henry's desire for a divorce. Henry had married his brother's widow. That is to say, Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain had a daughter named Catherine, sister of the mother of Charles V, the emperor, whom the arrangement had been made that she should marry Henry VII's oldest son. And she came over to England for that purpose. She came over, and he was 15 years of age, and so was she. And she brought a big dowry with her. And they were married at the age of 15 and lived together for 5 months. And then he died. And now, she being a widow at the age of 16, and it would have been the natural thing for her to go back to her parents in Spain. But she'd brought a big dowry, brought from the gold brought from America to Spain, and Henry VII, who was a very frugal man and put England on a solid basis financially, and then Henry VIII spent most of what Henry VII had gathered. Henry VII couldn't bear to give up the dowry, so he said, "Why shouldn't she marry my other son?" Well, they said it's against the canon law. According to the canon law, a man shall not marry his brother's widow. Well, they said they were only 15, they were just children anyway. Why can't she marry the other brother? Well, they said we'd have to have a special dispensation from the Pope. So they sent to the Pope, and for a sizable sum of money, but far less than the dowry they were saving, he gave a special dispensation whereby she could marry the other brother, who was a little younger than she was. Henry VIII. So it wasn't his choice at all to marry her. They were quite young when they were married. But he lived with her then for a good many years. And in the course of these years, she had four or five sons or children born dead. She had a sizable number of miscarriages. She had one child that lived, a daughter. And the English people were, of all things, they wanted a legitimate ruler who would, all the English people would agree with the ruler, and they wouldn't have a repetition of the fighting of the previous century of the War of the Roses. And I was talking with an Englishman a few years ago, and I referred to this, and he said that he felt that it was because of the, he was a physician, but he hadn't been there at that time, so I think it was only guesswork on his part, but he felt that Henry VIII had been a very licentious man from his childhood, and he felt quite sure he had contracted syphilis, and that that was the reason why his wife had all these misfortunes. Now, that may be a pure guess. We have, as they say, this man couldn't examine because he lived 300 years later, 400 years later, and so we don't know. But at any rate, Henry said, it says in Leviticus, if a man shall take his brother's wife, they shall be childless. And he said, here is this worked out. We have one daughter, no other children. All these misfortunes Catherine has had, he says, we should, I should have a different wife who can give me a son of whose legitimacy there will be no question, and there will be, it will be possible for when I die for England to remain united, because there won't be two factions claiming a different person is the proper ruler. And so Henry sent to the Pope a request. He sent two requests to him. There were two requests. He had fallen very much in love with a girl named Anne Boleyn. And there were two requests that he sent to the Pope. The first of these was that the Pope would annul his marriage to Catherine, because he said she was his brother's widow, and therefore it was against canon law for him to marry her in the first place. Well, of course, another pope had given special permission to him. Nevertheless, if they paid enough, the popes probably wouldn't have raised much objection to annulling it under these circumstances, under ordinary circumstances. So he asked the pope to give him a divorce or an annulment of his marriage to Catherine. Then he had a second request sent at the same time. He said, a girl named Mary Boleyn has been living with me as a concubine for two or three years. And he said, it's against canon law after you live with one woman to marry her sister. But he said, I'm in love with Anne Boleyn. And he said, I want a special dispensation from the Pope that despite my previous relations with Mary Boleyn, I may be permitted to marry Anne. And the Pope gladly gave him the second request. Gave him the permission to marry Anne despite his previous relations with Mary. But he raised all kinds of questions about giving him the divorce. And there's good reason why he should. Because Catherine was the aunt of Charles V, the emperor. And at the time when Henry's representatives came to Rome to ask for this permission, the troops of Charles V had seized Rome, which they held for many months, and the Pope was living in the Castle Sant'Angelo with the strong walls guarding him, and the forces of the emperor allowed messengers to come in and out, but the Pope couldn't leave, and he didn't know when they might decide to attack and break through the walls and seize him, which they never did do. But under the circumstances, with the emperor's troops holding him in that condition, how could he give permission to make the emperor, insult the emperor, by giving Henry permission to divorce the emperor's aunt? So the Pope had to postpone decision on this, say that a council of his men would consider the matter and they would look into it thoroughly, although the permission to marry Anne Boleyn, if he was divorced, was readily given. Yes? I don't think so. He was probably a few months getting the arrangements made in England to send the request to the Pope, and there were no telegraphs or anything like that. He knew Charles's forces were in Italy. He doubtless knew that. He knew the Pope and the Emperor were having difficulties. The Emperor was a very powerful man. He knew that. But that they actually had taken Rome, he probably didn't hear that till later. Yes?
Henry was trying to stir up trouble.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Henry had been for 2 or 3 years desperately in love with Anne Boleyn. He was very anxious to marry her, but she was unlike any woman he'd ever met before. She refused to have physical relations with him unless they were married. Her sister had readily lived with him for some time, as had various other women. But Anne refused him unless they were married. And, of course, anyway, Henry wanted a legitimate son who could take over the throne, and all of his supporters wanted, above all things, they did not want to return to a divided condition in the country where there would be fighting and bloodshed and destruction, and nobody would know when he would be safe. And so Henry's desire for a divorce here began to make a change in Henry's attitude. And Henry told Charles V's ambassador, whom he had called in his writing on the seventh sacrament the wolf of hell and the limb of Satan, he said to the imperial ambassador, he said, there's some heresy in Luther's books, but he said that's no sufficient reason for reproving and rejecting the many truths he has brought to light. And the man who was head of the church in England and was also head of the government under Henry called upon to get him this divorce. And Wolsey tried repeatedly, and when he was unable to get it from the Pope, he had Wolsey removed from his office and ordered his execution. Wolsey said, had I served my God as diligently as I have served my king, he would not have given me over in my gray hairs. And under these circumstances, Henry relaxed his efforts to prevent the coming of Luther's ideas into England. And a man in one of the universities saw Henry and suggested to him, he said, after all, why should you let the Pope dictate these matters? You're the ruler in England. Why don't you declare independence of the Pope? Give me authority to pass on the matter, and I will declare you divorced. And Henry thought it was a good idea. And so he began to move away from relations with the Church of Rome. But to say that Henry was the founder of the Church of England or made the English Reformation is a complete misrepresentation. Henry ceased to oppose the coming of the Reformation as strongly as he had and made it possible for it to gain headway much faster than it would have otherwise. And so the political events were thus used of God to allow the coming in of it. Though Henry hated Tyndale and caused Tyndale eventually to be killed on the continent, and eventually when Henry gave permission for the issuance of a Bible in English in England, when Henry did, they took Tyndale's translation, but they put another name on it because they knew Henry would never approve of it if he knew Tyndale had anything to do with it. But Tyndale was responsible for the greater part of the translation. Well, now, the English Reformation is very important to us, but we have many other things to look at first. I've just given you a picture here of its beginning. In fact, I didn't intend to give quite as much detail at this point as I have. I hope you'll remember that when we come to look further at it and at what followed. But we want to briefly mention number two, Scotland. In Scotland, already the knowledge of Luther's works had come to Scotland, and not only the knowledge of his works, but there was a very fine young man named Patrick Hamilton. Patrick Hamilton, who studied on the continent, and who there on the continent studied Luther's works and became convinced they were right, and went back to Scotland and began to spread the biblical message, and he was seized and he was burned at the stake in February 1528, the first of the Scottish Protestants, outstanding Protestants, the first of the Scottish martyrs. One of the opponents said, the reek of Patrick Hamilton infected all upon whom it blew. And so there was already a small group of educated people in Scotland who were beginning to take an interest in Luther's writing and in studying the Bible more than had been done in that land before. Number three, the Netherlands. The Netherlands, as you know, is what we today call Holland and Belgium. They make one unit together, Holland and Belgium. They were divided by later circumstances, a century after this time. But at this time, they were one region, quite a united region, and the greatest prosperity was in the section we now call Northern Belgium. That was the greatest prosperity of the Netherlands at that time. But it was one united area, and in that area, which belonged to the emperor, but which received its prosperity and almost entirely through trade, so it was very difficult to enforce strict laws there without wrecking the whole life of the country. It was so dependent on trade. And therefore, it was one of the earliest places where Luther's doctrine spread. As early as July 1st, 1523, the first martyrs for the Reformation were burned at Brussels, which is today the capital of Belgium. They were the first martyrs anywhere of the Reformation. And Luther wrote a hymn on the subject and published an open letter to the Christians of the Netherlands. And people began in the Netherlands to study Luther's writings. Many people in this area began to follow the Protestant teachings. But Charles I had been brought up in this area. They considered him one of their own. And he was so popular that even though hundreds of people were killed for their turning to the Reformation by Charles, and even though his agents were busy seeking them out for the next 30 years, when Charles re-abdicated, the people just wept with sorrow at losing him. There was such a personal attachment in this area to the Emperor Charles. But it's one of the areas where the Reformation quickly got started, largely through Luther's writings. Well, we'll continue there tomorrow morning.